Hey, this is Derek, and you're listening to Skepticality, the official audio program of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, March 12th, 2013. Skepticality. Welcome back to another episode of Skepticality, the audio program which brings you news and interviews on science, critical thinking, and, well, science. I said that already, didn't I? So before I get into this episode, I wanted to let you all know about a cool event. It's going to happen this weekend here in the Atlanta, Georgia area. It will feature a live stage show and recording of three Critical Thought podcasts. It'll include Blake Smith of our sister Skeptic Magazine podcast, Monster Talk, John Snyder of American Freethought, and we here at Skepticality. The live show will be at the local watering hole, Manuel's Tavern, which is in the Virginia Highlands area of downtown Atlanta. There won't be just our live group recording show, but also an auction of all sorts of great skeptical and science-related items. The event is a fundraiser for Skepticamp. So encourage anyone and everyone who can make it to the Atlanta area this coming weekend for some fun, possibly become the winner of some cool skeptic tidbits to take home. So while you go figure out how to get out of that pressing social event you had for this Saturday evening, I'll let you listen to Tim Farley and a group of our normal contributors.
I'm Tim Farley of whatstheharm.net and skeptools.com, and this is Skepticism Past and Future. This time around, we've got gaming of the system, followed by gamification. Over the history of skepticism, pseudoscientists and paranormalists have tried to game the system in various ways, many, many times. One way is to try to feign legitimacy. This month is the 100th anniversary of American chiropractors seeking legitimacy through regulation. On March 18, 1913, the state of Kansas adopted House Bill No. 75 and thereby became the first U.S. state to license chiropractors. The first license was issued under this law in May of 1915. It took until the 1970s, but eventually every U.S. state enacted similar legislation. And today we are seeing similar legislative ploys by homeopaths and naturopaths for legitimacy so that they can qualify as providers under Obamacare. In 1973, a different grab for legitimacy was made by a paranormalist. Uri Geller sought the stamp of approval of the scientific establishment by virtue of having his alleged abilities tested by scientists at the Stanford Research Institute. James Randi and others suspected that Geller was merely using conjuring tricks to fool the scientists. Consulting with Time magazine, Randi explained how the scientists could get positive results and yet still be wrong, and the magazine published the story in an article titled The Magician and the Think Tank on March 12, 1973. It was the beginning of a long battle between Uri Geller versus Randi and the skeptics, including several lawsuits. My final example of gaming the system also involves Randi and took place on March 16, 1986. That was the day that faith-healing evangelist Peter Popoff appeared at a theater in Anaheim, California. James Randi and a technical crew were ready for him, and at this appearance, they were able to determine that Popoff was receiving messages from backstage via an earpiece. Randi later reported on The Tonight Show that Popoff claimed to hear messages from God. But if so, Randi had determined that God's frequency is 39.17 megahertz. In theory, skeptics shouldn't need to game any systems in our favor because we have science and logic on our side. But in this internet era, many interesting techniques have arisen to help motivate and enable people to interact online. And one of these techniques is called gamification. This is when the same psychological techniques used by computer games to capture your attention are applied to other non-game environments. For instance, some websites reward you with additional capabilities based on your level of participation. The social media tool Foursquare and others award badges when users of the site reach certain milestones. Many other sites employ similar techniques. I've written how I'd like to see more effort to apply these techniques to skeptical activities online. Many forms of skeptical activism can be dreadfully tedious. By the time you've answered the same incorrect statement about evolution or vaccines online 10 or more times, you start to wonder whether it will ever end. Some way to reward skeptics, even through the silliness of game mechanics, might help lessen the tedium of this. And indeed, some sites employing this strategy have already been built. One is Skeptic Stack Exchange, a question and answer site, and it's a good example. It rewards participation through a scoring system that grants you additional capabilities. It has badges, and it has a leaderboard to reward the top skeptics who interact on the site with bragging rights. The skeptical rebuttal tool Rebutter also has a simpler scoring system that will tell you how many rebuttals you've contributed, how you rank among other users of the system. I've also proposed on my blog that a more general system for gamifying skeptical participation could be built. Well, now there's a new gamified skeptic software tool focused on climate change. At the end of February, a group called the Climate Reality Project launched a new site called Reality Drop. There's a huge amount of misinformation about climate change being posted online, and responding to it all is an unimaginably large task. Reality Drop turns it into a game. The site points out bad articles that deny science, which need rebuttals in the comments. They also draw attention to well-written articles that you can post to your friends on social media to combat misconceptions. Convenient factoids about climate science are provided right on the site so you can link to them. Much of this material was sourced from John Cook's excellent Skeptical Science website by virtue of that site's Creative Commons licensing. This is a good example of Creative Commons encouraging skeptics to build on each other's work. The Reality Drop site provides easy links to help you post your own rebuttals or social media posts to Twitter or Facebook, and gives you scores and badges as you do this, so you can compete in the game of rebutting bad climate information all over the web using the Reality Drop site. The hope is that the ongoing job of combating climate misinformation will become fun and less of a drudge. I encourage all skeptics who are interested in the climate change issue to give the site a look and watch the introductory video. And this brings us to the end of another edition of Skepticism Past and Future. Links to additional material are in the show notes, and follow me on Twitter or Facebook under the name Krelnik, K-R-E-L-N-I-K, where I post a daily fact from Skepticism's past and ongoing news of Skepticism's future.
I'm Heather Henderson, and this is the News in Religion. The Vatican announced Friday that the Catholic Church's College of Cardinals will begin the closed-door papal conclave meetings to elect the new pope on the afternoon of Tuesday, March 12. All cardinals under 80 years old are eligible to vote for the successor to Pope Benedict, who retired on February 28. That leaves 115 cardinals who will vote at the Sistine Chapel. Typically, conclaves are supposed to happen at least 15 days and no more than 20 days after a pope dies or leaves office, but Benedict changed the rules in the last days of his papacy to allow an earlier start. There are a handful of cardinals who are rumored to be in the running to be pope, though no clear front runner has emerged. A new study by Canadian academics says Mother Teresa was a product of hype who housed the poor and sick in shoddy conditions despite her access to a fortune. The Times of India, reporting on the controversial essay, wrote that the authors asserted Mother Teresa saw beauty in the downtrodden suffering and was far more willing to pray for them than provide practical medical care. Meanwhile, researchers say the Vatican engaged in a PR ploy as it threw aside concerns about her suspicious financial dealings and contacts to forego the 5-year waiting period to beatify her. A research paper claims that the celebrated nun had 517 missions in 100 countries at the time of her death, but that the majority of patients were not cared for properly and many were left to die. The website of the Nobel Peace Prize, which Mother Teresa won in 1979, takes a far more positive view of her deeds. It celebrates her early work in Calcutta's slums and credits her order and its outgrowths with providing effective help to the poorest of the poor in a number of countries. Mother Teresa died in 1997 at age 87. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad believes that Hugo Chavez will return on Resurrection Day with Jesus Christ and will establish peace, justice, and kindness on earth. In September, Ahmadinejad spoke of this resurrection during the United Nations General Assembly. After the death of Chavez on Tuesday afternoon, he released a statement on Wednesday to announce a day of public mourning. The arrival of the ultimate savior will mark a new beginning, a rebirth, and a resurrection. It will be the beginning of peace, lasting security, and genuine life, he said in part. His arrival will be the end of oppression, immorality, poverty, discrimination, and the beginning of justice, love, and empathy. Chavez died Tuesday afternoon, 4:25 p.m. Caracas time, after a nearly 2-year struggle with cancer. I'm Heather Henderson, and this was the News and Religion. Visit my other podcasts at ardentatheist.com and skepticallyyours.net. Special thanks to my audio engineer, Emery Emery. The News and Religion was brought to you through the Scientific Method.
Hello, this is Susan Gerbic from the Grilla Skepticism on Wikipedia project. Wikipedia is the 5th most visited internet site in the world. The Grilla Skepticism and World Wikipedia Project hope to capitalize on that to raise a skeptical footprint. The very first World Wikipedia Project began when we started in August 2012, where they were assigned by me to add one image to all James Randi Wikipedia pages we could find. The image is one I took at TAM9 with a group of 100 skeptics wearing the IIG Randi beards we sold. Randi, with arms outstretched, is in the very front of the group with a big smile and his own white beard. Ross Blotcher, yes, that Ross from the Oh No, Ross and Carrie podcast, edited the image into the amazing photo that you will see in the James Randi Wikipedia page currently. One reason I chose this image is to counter the belief that skeptics are grumpy curmudgeons. We need all the good press we can get. When you click on the image, you will be able to see many friendly and hopefully familiar faces and nothing grumpy about us. I asked for a representative from each of my language teams to add this photo to their James Randi pages. So far, this image has been added in Arabic, Dutch, French, German, Hebrew, Norsk, Portuguese, Russian, Spanish, Swedish, and Turkish. As the team grows, so will our outreach. The World Wikipedia Project has only existed since August 2012, yet already they've made many additions to Wikipedia. New pages have been created for Jerry Andrus. You might remember him as the optical illusion inventor, who was a fixture at TAM for many years, and also at the Skeptics Toolbox. His page is now available in Arabic, Dutch, Russian, Spanish, Swedish, and Portuguese. Bob Carroll from the Skeptics Dictionary now has his page in Dutch and French. Paul Kurtz received new pages in Russian and Portuguese. Spanish added a Skeptic Camp page. Dutch rewrote the James Randi and Michael Shermer pages. And the prolific Portuguese team has added Phil Plait, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Power Balance, Martin Garner, Penn and Teller, Eric Von Doniggen, Indigo House, Indigo Children, and Ray Hyman for their readers, and even more. This sounds like a lot in the last few months, and it is, but there is still so much more to do. If you'd like to be involved in a project that exposes thousands of readers to skepticism across the world, please visit our blog at gorillaskepticismonwikipedia.blogspot.com. We train, and you don't have to be bilingual to participate. Once you've familiarized yourself with my blog, please friend me on Facebook and let me know where your interest lies, and I'll get you started. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to The Odds Must Be Crazy on Skepticality, where we interrupt this unscheduled podcast to bring you a story you didn't expect to hear. Unless you heard this one already. Then you totally knew this was coming.
I'm Wendy Hughes.
And I'm Jarrett Kaufman.
And we're here to tell you stories that take your breath away, like getting hit in the chest with a football.
This is the latest in our long-running line of same-name stories. You can find it on our site starting today by searching for The Popes of Finnish Football, or by clicking on the link in the show notes.
It feels like same-name stories are almost taking over. The odds must be crazy.
Yep, and this one has a couple of interesting twists. Brian Pope, one of several in this story, writes, "My name is Brian Pope. I am an American, and I have lived here in Vantaa, Finland, for the past 5.5 years. I play football, soccer for my North American brethren, and I'm a goalkeeper. A few years ago, I got a message from a teammate asking if I had given up on our hobby league football team and signed up for a pro club in Vaasa, Finland. Now, I believe myself to be a decent keeper, but no means pro level. My teammate sent me a link that announced the signing of an American goalkeeper named Brian Pope to VPS. I thought this was very entertaining. Through Facebook, I was able to track down this other American goalkeeper named Brian Pope and relayed the coincidence. He enjoyed the story as well. During the same time, my wife's cousin, who lives in Vaasa, happened by an apartment where the name on the mail slot said Brian Pope and snapped a picture. She thought it was pretty amazing to have another Brian Pope in Finland. She didn't know that I knew there was another person by the same name living in Vaasa, so I relayed the story to her. What are the odds that there were two Brian Popes living in Finland at the same time, both being football goalkeepers? Granted, at different levels of football. The fact that my wife's cousin happened by that mail slot is another set of odds altogether."
That's really cute. Every time I start to get tired of the same name stories, we get a whole different angle from someone.
Yep, they keep sucking us back in. This one seemed to have a lot of extra personal significance to our submitter, too.
I think it has a lot to do with living away from home, a little like homesickness. Anyway, Barbara Drescher, our resident statistician and cognitive psychologist, researched the odds of a coincidence like this.
Barbara basically explained this story in terms of comfort and geography, and her own reaction to the story Brian submitted. She said, "The odds of this are a little more difficult to calculate than most of the other same-name stories that we get, mostly because the frequencies of names in Finland in past years are not easy to find. Both his first and last names are fairly common in the U.S., but I found myself impressed with the coincidences in the story, and it is my own amazement, once again, that I think is interesting."
I think it's important to know why Barbara finds the stories attract her attention. She knows what factors to take into consideration.
Absolutely. In so many cases, what makes a story unusual goes on primarily in the mind of the observer. Barbara explained what it was about this one that struck her. "Soccer is an extremely popular sport, so even the fact that few soccer players are goalkeepers should not make this story so surprising. However, there is an aspect of the story that explains my feelings. Distance and familiarity. Familiar settings provide frames of reference to anchor us. We are more confident with our estimates of everything from accident rates to salaries when the context is familiar. Finland is not a familiar place to most Americans. Numbers of Americans living in that part of the world are also not available, but whoever talks about moving to Finland? France, Italy, even Egypt are more likely. There's no Eiffel Tower, no pyramids, and no Riviera. Finland does not seem exotic, it just feels foreign, and the lack of familiar context seems to make the presence of such a common, American-sounding name feel more out of place than it probably was."
Sports are popular everywhere, but it's true, I've never heard of someone moving to Finland, although I know someone from there.
And unlike previous stories we've had about people running into one another in highly popular tourist destinations such as Tokyo, there is something extra special about it occurring in a less common location. And it's so much more personal when your home country and even your name line up.
Plus, when he tells people his name and they ask, "The American goalkeeper?" He won't be lying when he says yes. I bet he gets a lot of free drinks that way.
Leave it to you to always look for an angle. Thanks for listening to The Odds Must Be Crazy. Make sure to stop by the site and troll us in the comment threads. Or, if you really want to stick it to us, you can be polite and respectful. That'll show us.
Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, circle us on Google+, and validate us in life. Hit the Submit a Story link on our site to share your own crazy stories, or tweet the short ones with the hashtag TOMBC.
The Odds Must Be Crazy is a project in collaboration with the Independent Investigations Group in Los Angeles, California. Visit them at iigwest.org. Barbara Drescher is a contributing editor to our blog and can also be found at icbseverywhere.com.
Our theme music comes to us courtesy of Mr. Deity himself, Brian Keith Dalton. You can find him at MrDeity.com.
So where do you feel most comfortable and connected with, Wendy?
I feel pretty happily familiar with the good old San Fernando Valley, Jarrett.
No Eiffel Tower, no pyramids, no Riviera. You're a valley girl at heart, huh?
Just call me Moon Unit.
A joke for five listeners.
Thanks again, everybody. So for our interview this week, I bring you a discussion. I was able to record this with Professor of Earth and Space Scientists at the University of Washington, David R. Montgomery. David released his newest book, The Rocks Don't Lie, A Geologist Investigates Noah's Flood. I was first tipped off about this great book by our friend Donald Prothero. He is also part of the Skeptic Magazine crew. So I wanted to find out more about what sparked someone like David to dip his toe into the waters of writing on such a skeptical topic as the Noah's Flood story. So, I am here today with, are you David? David?
Either way is fine.
Yeah, all right. David Montgomery. Montgomery, wow. Hard name to say, obviously. Tell us a little bit about your background and what you specialize in.
Well, I'm a geomorphologist, and that's the kind of geologist who studies how landscapes evolve, how mountain ranges evolve, how rivers work, sort of the erosional part of the here and now of geology. So I'm a geologist by training and a geomorphologist by practice.
Geomorphologist. I never really heard about that until I did some reading of your book and things about you. So, like you said, it deals with soil and erosion and things like that. Is that actually a common, is that something that's been around for a while?
Well, it's actually the word geomorphology was invented in the 1890s when the people who studied the evolution of the surface forms of the earth, topography, wanted to be different than geologists. And they made the word up for a conference in, I think, 1891. So the word has been around for a while, but it's been a pretty well-kept secret. There's not a lot of geomorphologists in the world. And most of the time when people ask what I do, I say, I'm a geologist because that's what my degrees are technically in. And that's sort of the big hat that I wear.
Geomorphologist actually sounds much cooler.
Well, yeah, it is cool. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's a wonderful specialty. But as you were saying, most people have just never heard of it.
Yeah, I can't even say it. What are we going to do? So you work at the University of Washington?
Yeah, I teach in the Department of Earth and Space Sciences, which used to be the Department of Geology, at the University of Washington in Seattle.
You didn't make them change the name to the University of Morphology?
No, at one point I seriously suggested changing the department name to the Department of Earth, Air, Fire, and Water, but none of my colleagues went for it.
They didn't get the joke?
No.
That would have been the best.
We would have been the first one in the country. It would have been trendsetting.
People would go, what is that about? So I read in your book, and I actually have you on because your new book is The Rocks Don't Lie. And the tagline is a geologist investigates Noah's flood. And I read that you grew up going to Sunday school.
I did. I was raised Presbyterian and went to Sunday school as a kid. And, was exposed to the Bible stories and the whole deal growing up.
So how did a church-going kid end up taking on the topic of Noah's flood?
That's a long story, but I lay some of it out in the book. But the short view of it is that in the church that I was raised in, nobody really saw conflicts between science and religion. That I was taught that the story of Noah's flood was an allegory. It was there wasn't actually a global flood, but that it was the point of the story was the lesson that was conveyed by it about saving nature. It was sort of a green spin, frankly, when I was growing up through part of it. But the basic idea that there could be fundamental conflict between science and religion wasn't really the way I was taught in Sunday school. And so, I was really interested in science as a kid. I had the dinosaur fever that most kids have at a certain age, and ended up wanting to go into biology, majored in geology, as it turned out, in college, and sort of went on to a career as a geologist, became a geomorphologist. And I got interested in the origin of flood stories, sort of where stories of really big floods, including the story of Noah's flood, actually by discovering evidence for a huge flood in eastern Tibet about 10 years ago. So well into my career, I actually found evidence of a really giant flood and a folk story that the local Tibetans had that actually told of this big flood. And that got me interested in, like, well, were there actually geological events behind stories of big floods? And when you ask that question, you can't help but wrestle with the story of Noah's flood.
Ah. Now, what I liked about the book is you kind of take a really easygoing tone about in the book. Is that kind of on purpose because of the many other books that's come out in recent times?
Well, you know, when I first started writing the book, I wanted to write sort of a straightforward refutation of the idea of young earth creationism, the idea that some people read into the Bible that the world is 6,000 years old and that Noah's flood shaped all the world's topography, which is an idea that geologists really put to rest, you know, centuries ago. And the more I got into reading and doing my research for the book, the more I realized that there was actually a more interesting story in the back and forth between science and religion and how they influenced each other than the sort of the usual story we hear of sort of irreconcilable conflict and differences, of which, you know, creationists and geologists, that really is irreconcilably different views of the world. But as I got into writing the book, I didn't really want to write something that was essentially a polemic. I wanted to write a sort of examination of the history that looked into some of the interesting cross-pollination and the conflicts, but lay out the story, because I think a lot of the story of how geologists came to understand the long history of the Earth that we know of today actually was pushed along by efforts to demonstrate the reality of Noah's flood and or early on a global flood. And that kind of influence, that cross-pollination, if you will, between science and religion historically, it's kind of dropped off society's radar. We just hear creationists and Richard Dawkins screaming at each other, which, you know, I'm on Dawkins' side in terms of that one, in the sense that the creationists are wrong in their view of Earth history. But there's another angle to the, essentially the relationship between science and religion that you can explore in a more laid-back fashion. So I was trying to write an interesting and informative treatment of the subject rather than you know, to instill the world with Dave's view of how you ought to look at it.
Yeah, because right in the beginning of the book, you talked about your research on Ice Age glacial dams and floods, and you actually kind of weave the story of how it reveals that there's no evidence at all about a giant global flood.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's really no evidence for a giant global flood in the rock record. And geologists figured this out by the early 1800s. You know, before Darwin ever got on board the Beagle, the geologic model that modern creationists offer in their fight against evolution was completely refuted by geologists. And very few people know that in today's modern sort of arguments and wars over evolution. And this book is not about evolution. I'm not a paleontologist. I'm not a biologist. I wanted to frame it differently. But when you look at the story of Noah's flood and how geologists refuted the global flood story, but opened the door to thinking about, well, was it a regional or a local flood? Could there actually be a historical event that got picked up by an oral tradition that evolved into the biblical story? There's actually reasonable arguments for how that could have happened, it turns out. But the idea of a global flood has been refuted for a long time. And that's really the only model that creationists offer in their fight against evolution. And because if you basically acknowledge the long history of the world, the ancient age of the world, then it gives time for evolution to actually work.
Yeah, and it's funny because
they don't like that.
Yeah, you pointed out that the geologists and almost everybody, including theologists and Christian scholars, all rejected the idea of Noah's flood by around 1840.
Oh, yeah.
And like you said, before Darwin, but suddenly it became back in vogue, and now we have here in the United States, was it something like more than 70% of the people still think the Earth is not more than a couple thousand years old?
Yeah, the Gallup polls consistently indicate something like 40 to 45% of the American public, depending on how you phrase the question, of course. You get, you know, a substantial minority or a small majority of the American public believes things that geologists know are not true.
Yeah, and like you said, around 1840 until, you know, somewhat recently, there was no problem with that.
Yeah, I was actually quite surprised. And it's one of the examples of how when you start writing a book, you don't necessarily end up writing the one you thought you were going to do because you learn stuff along the way.
I hear that all the time.
Yeah, and as I looked into the sort of history of theology in the 19th century, I was really quite surprised to learn how mainstream Christianity and mainstream theologians had embraced the idea of a local or regional flood. Basically, the idea that the story of Noah's flood was either allegory or the story of a disastrous regional flood that seemed like it flooded the whole world to the people that actually experienced it. And that view was essentially a mainstream Christian view in the late 19th century. And the reason it was adopted was because there was this longstanding theological tradition that goes, you can trace all the way back to, you know, the second or third century A.D., that things we learn about the natural world, things that we would call science now, our understanding of how the world works, is actually a form of revelation about how God set the world up, as powerful and as true as what people might read in the Bible. And there's a long tradition of arguing about how do you interpret the Bible. And so if you have things where evidence that you can see for yourself in the world, things we could learn through science, conflicts with the way someone reads the Bible, then perhaps it's the interpretation of the Bible that ought to change rather than simply rejecting what you can see and learn for yourself. So in the 19th century, as geologists started to discover the long and complicated history of the world, theologians started to respond by saying, oh, well, okay, there wasn't just one global flood. That doesn't explain all of geologic history, as had been argued in the 17th and 18th centuries. And so their efforts just kind of reconcile science and religion along the way. And so one of the things I got very interested in researching the book is how did it come to be that that modern creationism became such a force today? And where did those ideas come from? How were those ideas revived in the 20th century? And so I spend part of the latter part of the book looking into how those ideas were sort of incubated in a bubble and then reemerged in the 1960s with the publication of a very influential book that I ended up looking into and convincing myself to read, and it was took the efforts to try and understand.
Yeah, well, I think it would probably take an effort to understand it, especially these days.
You can trace the roots of modern creationism, the sort of revival of the idea of the world as very young, a few thousand years old, and Noah's flood shaped all the world's topography, back to this book that was published in 1961 called The Genesis Flood. It was written by an Old Testament theologian and a hydraulic engineer, and they're very clear about their motivation. They basically think that they could you should read the Bible to figure out what geologic history really was, and then go look for evidence in the rocks that backs up your story and ignore everything else. They're pretty actually straightforward and clear about that. And which, as a scientist, you kind of go like, really? That's kind of backwards.
Yeah.
But what I was really surprised by, frankly, was how they motivate their book with a very insightful critique of 1950s geology, of pre-plate tectonics geology. And if you think about what plate tectonics did to the science of geology, it was a lot like what the discovery of DNA did to genetics. It basically provided the mechanism for how it would work. And so in the 1950s, geologists didn't have good answers for why are there, you know, basic questions. Why are there mountains? Why are there marine sedimentary rocks, rocks with seashells in them, on top of mountains in parts of the world? Why are there fossils of tropical animals at the poles? There were sort of basic questions geologists couldn't answer. And the guys who wrote The Genesis Flood basically said, oh, we have the answers. You know, we can read it in the Bible, and then we'll go look for the rock, for the evidence that supports us. And their view really resonated very profoundly with people who at the time in the early 1960s were looking to fight the teaching of evolution in public schools. And it took off.
Yeah, I guess.
But their views are pretty much not widely embraced in the most of the 20th century and even in the evangelical community.
So it's more a very modern thing.
It's a young earth creationism, as it turns out, is a very modern idea. I mean, the roots of it extend deeply back to, you know, Bishop Usher and people thinking that the world is very young in previous centuries. But those ideas are well soundly refuted and abandoned. And so the modern creationism is sort of a new revived beast.
That's funny because in the second or third chapter of the book, a couple of years ago, me and my family, we took a trip to the Grand Canyon, actually right after TAM 1 year. And and we went to the Grand Canyon, and of course we went to the bookshop, and I found amusing that you also found the same book that we found that you highlighted for your second chapter of the book that you used to like kind of highlight your journey through the Grand Canyon. You using this, I can't imagine why they keep this book in the gift shop of the Grand Canyon, and it's all about the reality of how the Grand Canyon was formed from a creationist's view.
Yeah, I think it's called the Grand Canyon, A Different View, or something.
Yeah, I think that's actually the name of it. Yeah,
and it certainly is a different view. I when you walk up the Grand Canyon as a geologist from the bottom to the top, it's an amazing experience. You can just read this whole complicated history of the place, and you can't help but walk away just sort of immersed in the idea of deep time and thinking about, you know, how could there have been sort of like three different worlds essentially that are exposed in the rocks and the canyon walls, and how much time would it take to explain the comings and goings of the seas that you can see and the sand dunes. I mean, it's an amazing experience as a geologist. Then you get to the top, go to the bookstore, find this book that says, oh, it all happened, it was all created and sort of, it all formed in a single flood in a single year, you know, in direct contradiction of everything you've just read on the way up the valley wall. And so that's a wonderful question to ask the Park Service.
Did you?
Well, no, I did not. I was kind of stunned.
See, I did.
You know, and if I had thought at the time that I was going to be writing a book about it, I probably would have asked them.
Yeah, I asked the lady in the bookstore, and she looked at me like, you're too geeky, get out of here.
Oh, no. She's probably sitting there thinking, this is the best-selling book in here. What are you talking about?
I didn't ask that question. I probably didn't want the answer.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of like shocked that they would have that book. Because the national parks are supposed to educate people about reality. And I actually wrote a letter when I got home because of that book. I said, this should not be there. It's completely anti-science.
Well, it's factually wrong. Yeah. I mean, if you believe in science, it's factually wrong. And that's... But the, there was a big when that book was actually first placed in the bookstore at the Grand Canyon, there's a big controversy about it. And I think the presidents of the American Geophysical Union and GSA, wrote and complained to the Bush administration at the time about this. And, you know, they got nowhere. That basically they got them to change the book. I think it had originally been in the science section and it got moved to sort of its own special section, I think called Inspirational Reading or something. Yeah. But basically there was no political interest in pulling the book, for reasons that are probably apparent just given what administration it was in.
Oh, see, I didn't know that. It actually came out and was put there when Bush was in office.
Yeah.
Well, it makes more sense then.
Yeah. And I think that I believe that I don't know, you know, who placed the book in there or how that happened. And for all I know, somebody requested, you know, the citizen requested it and they followed through and did it. But there was political defense of keeping that book at high levels within the that administration. There's no interest in pulling it.
You know, facts and science, you can't have any of that.
No, there's... and there is sort of one of the sort of subtexts in the book that I don't really go into in the book, but a modern subtext that the themes that are explored in it plays into is, you know, the modern essential denial of science, how you can believe things that science are essentially showing are not true, or reject things that science is showing are true, things like global warming. it's an interesting era that we live in, shall we say.
Yeah, well, it's like people have to always remind me when I say all these people are anti-science. The sad part is, if you ask them a question about anything else about science, they usually will be very for it. So it's a weird dichotomy that we actually live in right now. Because
even James Imhoff will get on an airplane and fly somewhere, and that flies with physics.
The
physics basically is behind the whole concept of the greenhouse effect, but that doesn't make sense to him.
Well, you know, most of the GOP get labeled as anti-science, but yet they will love the science when it's out comes to like bombs and warfare. So,
So one of the things I found fascinating in researching this book is how many generations through centuries had wrestled with that tension between sort of faith in what you've been taught and faith or in belief in what you can see and learn for yourself, the sort of science and religion dichotomy. It's one of the long-running things people have wrestled with, and it's pretty hard to see evidence for things you've been taught are not true.
I've seen it happen to somebody in person, and inside of me, I had this little person going, "Yay, that's what we want, yay!" And then you see what happens to a person in front of your face, and you're like, you feel so bad for them.
Yeah,
because I mean, really, really does crush a person when they actually realize that they're wrong.
Yeah, well, I've actually had some interesting emails from folks who've read this book and. Thank you. This explains, like this one guy emailed me, that he had grown up in a creationist household, and had been taught to think that way, but had been struggling with it for years because of essentially the science of geology. How can generations, centuries worth of geologists actually have been deceiving the world? And laying the history of this thinking out, to him at least, clarified greatly sort of that tension, sort of why it was the people, the environment he was raised in viewed things the way they did. And actually a guy came to a book talk I gave a couple of weeks ago out here in Washington State, and he had been trained in seminary in the 1950s and taught the creationist beliefs. And he was wildly enthused about the book because it basically explained to him things that he'd been wrestling with for decades, because the more he learned about the world, the less he believed what he had been taught. And this book sort of put it into perspective for him, which he at least found useful.
And that's kind of the goal of these books.
I was really happy, yeah, because I didn't write this book to change creationist mind, because, it's hard to get someone to change their mind if they're predisposed to just not believe whatever you say. But I do have an abiding faith in the power of people to, when they're exposed to truth, to kind of sniff it out and recognize it. And creationism just doesn't ring true when you look at the record that's actually in the rocks. And thus the title of the book, The Rocks Don't Lie.
Exactly. So toward the end of the book, you actually lay out the idea that you believe that the Noah flood story might be just an ancient flooding events from all around the world, and yet, therefore, so many different faiths have the same story.
Yeah, one of the arguments creationists use to defend the idea of a global flood is that cultures around the world have stories of big floods, and many of them argue that, the whole world is flooded. But if you actually look into the geography of flood stories, and then you look at the details in them, the differences between flood stories map out really kind of nicely onto different ways that really big floods actually have happened in the geologic record. Not global floods, but floods that were big enough to seem like they flooded the whole world of people whose world was fairly small. And if you think about the key elements that you would need to be in a flood story, well, there's got to be a flood, the water's got to come up, and then somebody's got to survive it to actually tell people about it, or there wouldn't be a story. And those are the kind of elements that are common to all flood stories, the ones that kind of have to be. When you look at other details, like did the water come from the sky or did it come from the sea? Did the water rise, did the ocean rise, or did it come from the sea? Was there and other details? there's a lot of interesting differences. You look at flood stories from the western coast of North America, where I live, and a lot of the Native American stories of big floods read a lot like tsunamis. Basically, the ground shook, and the sea rose and swept inland to carry people away. It actually is a fairly decent description of something we know happens in the Northwest every few centuries, and that can be devastating to communities that live along coastal environments. Chilean natives had, Indians down in the west coast of South America and Chile had similar stories of the sea rising to flood, as did Tahitians and Fijians and Pacific Islanders. So in places where tsunamis are a big geologic process and a big natural hazard, there were stories of big floods, probably because there had been big floods that had happened there and they killed a lot of people in the past. There's also stories that read a lot like glacial dam break floods, like the story that of this big flood that we had discovered in, big ancient flood we discovered in Tibet 10 years or so back. And if you look at the places where it reads a lot like a glacial dam break, it's in places that had big walls of ice during the last deglaciation, where there probably were big dam breaks. And if you think about the history of humanity, the invention of the ability to write and radio, obviously, are very recent inventions. For most of our time on Earth, we've been conveying our experiences to one another with oral traditions. And, what better story could there be to pass on to your future generations than the story of a big flood that wiped out darn near everybody you knew?
When you don't have the advantage of, mobile phones or even like television, everybody died. And if you take your horse every direction for a couple of days, everybody's dead. So it's the entire world.
Yeah. Exactly. And if you look at if you then look and say, okay, well, what about the story of Noah's flood, and go straight to the sort of the big kahuna of flood stories, it turns out that there's actually two geologically plausible explanations for the origin of a story much like that. And one would be sort of a big flood in Mesopotamia, in the estuary of Mesopotamia, sort of the roots of the people who eventually whose descendants eventually wrote the Bible, lived in an area where it was naturally quite flood-prone and had a geography kind of similar to modern New Orleans. And I don't know if you've ever been to the convention center in New Orleans and looked at the sign that was up above, about 10 feet up in the air. It said sea level.
yeah.
And I went there for a conference years ago and sort of stood below that sign and went, oh, this is bad.
Yeah, people should not live here.
Yeah, this was long before Katrina.
Yeah.
And if you look at the reason that was that way is that the levees for big lowland river systems tend to be perched up above the surrounding terrain. And so that when the levee's over top, the surrounding terrain fills in like a bathtub. And Mesopotamia was really similar in pre-biblical days. And so the idea that if you had a big flood, say there was a ton of snow up in the Zagros Mountains, you had a big spring snow melt and flood that came down and inundated the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, it would have seemed like the whole world was flooded. And there's evidence and records of really big floods in the earliest records that we have from that region, thousands of years B.C., and you can even trace the biblical flood story along with the releasing of birds and the rainbow at the end, and all the way back from the Old Testament into Babylonian, into Akkadian, the language of Babylon, and then back into Sumerian, the earliest writing that we actually have. It's one of the world's oldest written stories. And so that's one option for this explaining the story of Noah's flood, would be a really big early Mesopotamian flood that got recorded in lore and handed down. And there was another event even earlier that is another plausible explanation that Bill Ryan and Walter Pittman, a pair of oceanographers, suggested back in the 1990s when they discovered that the Mediterranean Sea had overtopped the Bosporus and spilled into the valley of the Black Sea about 7,500, 8,000 years ago during deglaciation. As the ice was melting off the poles, sea level was rising because more water was getting into the oceans. The Mediterranean was connected to the world's oceans, and it overtopped the Bosporus and drained, essentially decanted, into this low-lying freshwater valley of the Black Sea and essentially topped it up to sea level. Now, if you'd been living in the valley of the Black Sea, as what Ryan Pittman argued early agricultural peoples were, it would have seemed like your whole world basically was flooded from a mysterious source, like the gates of, you know, the floodgates of the world or floodgates of heaven, or whatever you want to call it, opened up because the world's oceans were draining into your valley. Now, was that the root of the story of Noah's flood? You know, that'll probably never be known because the evidence, I don't think you could ever find evidence to prove an oral history that way. But it does provide a plausible explanation that one might look to as a potential source. So, you know, the idea of a global flood, the way that creationists interpret the story of Noah's flood, we can refute that. I mean, the science of geology has soundly refuted that. But the idea that a big regional flood that would have seemed like the whole world to the people in that region at the time might have been at the root of the story of Noah's flood, you know, you can't really dismiss that possibility. There's a good chance that that's the root of it, because there's so clear a tie of the other world, the world's other flood stories, to the kinds of events that would make big floods in those particular regions.
It's amazing when I think about the geology of the area you just talked about, how big that flood had to be.
Oh, for the Black Sea?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would have been immense. I mean, I think that the models that I've seen that have argued that it took, you know, about a month or so for the water in the Black Sea to rise up to sea level. And so you would have just imagined the oceans spilling into a valley for a month.
Yeah.
It would have been the world's most spectacular waterfall.
But I would think about everything else that had to be underwater for that to happen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole, whatever was around the valley bottom was basically submerged really rapidly. You probably might have been hard to walk out of the way of the flood, because if you have a fairly flat valley bottom, as if you look at the bathymetry of the Black Sea and you look down at sort of what is now submerged, there were some very broad, flat coastal areas that were probably really good land for growing food. And the quirks of, if you have a sort of a flat receptacle that you're draining water into, so a flat bottomed valley with steep walls like the valley of the Black Sea was, if you start filling it up with water, how do you get out of it? You know, if you walk, if you're a long way from the edge and you try and walk to the edge, well, if it's filling up fast enough, you go underwater. It would have been a spectacular flood. One certainly worth telling one's kids about had one survived.
It sounds like another idea for a new Michael Mann spectacle big budget movie.
Oh, there you go. That. Yeah.
I just want to see the special effects for that.
You know, they could probably make it look amazing.
Exactly. So you kind of gave away the end of your book. Oh, well, although it's a science book. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have a story.
Yeah. So, well, you know, the book is tries to tie all these things together and explore the history and the thinking behind it. It was a fun book to write. It took me a lot longer than I thought it would, because I had to actually, you know, I'm trained as a geologist, so I've got the science perspective and end of it down. But what I really wasn't prepared what I thought I was better prepared to write about than I turned out to be was the history of theology, because it turned out to be far more subtle and interesting than I ever thought. I had sort of a cartoon view of the way that theology had looked at what scientists had discovered over the centuries. And that part took me an extra couple years to actually do the reading to try and get the story right.
Well, a lot of that is a byproduct of, like you mentioned earlier, that how things have happened since around the 50s or the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the views that had been widely discredited, like the basic view that, what we could learn through the application of science would somehow undermine what people might believe about the nature of the world and how it was put together about religion. The idea that those could be fundamentally in conflict is actually a fairly new idea. And that was a surprise to me.
Yeah, maybe we'll blame things like Fox News.
Well, I don't think that in general, anyone who's sort of promoting a sort of a non-critical acceptance view of what people tell them is contributing to the problem. And Fox is certainly on board for that, at least in some manners.
24-hour news cycle, we blame all of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other part is that it's more entertaining to talk about conflict than it is about cross-pollination or influences. And, and heaven forbid you want to talk about subtlety.
Oh, no. You can't. Everything has to be black or white. You can't you can't flip-flop. You can't learn something new. You can't do that.
Yeah, and actually I think that point that you just made, learning something new, that's at the heart of the whole issue. Because it's like if you look at what really separates, I think, people from most of the rest of the animals on the planet, we have a pretty finely tuned ability to learn new things should we put our mind to it. We're pretty darn clever as a species. That's our hallmark, if you will. And so what sense does it make for us to essentially abandon the ability to update our thinking and process new information, learn new things, learn about the world? I mean, that's the basic modus operandi of science, is to investigate, poke around, satisfy our curiosity, try and figure out how things work. And yet views like modern creationism that essentially build a wall and say, no, we're not going to accept geology because it does not actually conform. Its findings, the new things it's learned, do not conform to our beliefs. It just goes so against the grain for what's made us the dominant species on the planet that it can't be in our best interest to stop learning new things.
But it's not good for ratings.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's that.
So why don't you tell people a little bit where they can find you, a little bit more about your book. Are you doing any speaking engagements and people can see you somewhere?
Yeah, I'm doing. Been doing talks about the book in places as invitations come in. Some stuff down in the Bay Area this spring, should be in April or May, I believe. I'm actually going out to Kansas next week, I think. If people are interested in looking at the research that I do in the Department of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington, if you Google Geomorphological Research Group, you can find my group's webpage and any of the stuff that I've published. You can download there, except of course the book there's a link to Amazon or something there. But yeah, I would encourage people, if they're interested in the subject, to check the book out. And I'm not that hard to find. David R. Montgomery.
And you can maybe you'll convince other people to be geomorphologists as well.
It's, being able to, the privilege of being able to call work, the studying how the world works and how it's shaped is something I still sort of pinch myself about every year. It's a tremendous field to practice.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for taking time to be on the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk.
I'd like to once again thank David for taking some time out of his busy schedule to talk with me, and also to remind everybody you can find a direct link to where you can grab your own copy of The Rocks Don't Lie. It'll be in the show notes for this episode. Also, if you want to come and see the live recording of Skepticality, Monster Talk, and American Free Thought this weekend, you can find a link to all the details and where you can RSVP to be a part of the audience at the AtlantaSkepticsMeetup.com website. There will be a direct link to that event, as well as all the other things you heard in this episode, in the show notes.
which are over at our website, which is www.skepticality.com.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app for iOS, Android, Kindle, PC, or Macintosh. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite skeptical content.